and welcome to the Creighton Crowbar. It's episode 40 of our podcast, taking place on the 29th of April. I'm Marsh Davis, and I'm joined by Graham Smith.
Hello.
Chris Thurston.
Hi.
And Tom Senior.
Hello.
It's a very special Dark Souls bonanza this week, since loads of us have been playing it, and also the sequel.
Yeah.
Who wants to go first?
Well, not me, because I'm the only one who hasn't been playing it.
No. In that case...
Graham should go first.
Yeah, you should go first.
Now the listener has a little sense of what's coming.
You really want to build up that tension?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I've been playing a game called Limbs. Or maybe Limb Repair Workshop? Maybe. Uh-huh. It's not clear. It's a game made for Cyberpunk Game Jam. It was a couple of months ago. And basically, it's like Papers, Please, but instead of working as a border patrol agent, you work as a man in a cyberpunk future who repairs robot hands. So you've got your workbench, and there's a conveyor belt, you press a button, and you get like a work order come through from a guy who says, I just beat a man to death, my hand's broken, can you fix it for me? And you've got the hand in front of you, and you need to check his warranty to make sure that it's, still valid. And then you screw off the skin, you press the screw to unscrew it, take off the skin, check the barcode inside to make sure that matches up to his warranty, and then you work out what the problem is by, screwing off the circuit board, checking the capacitor, taking off the fingers because they're broken because he's just beaten a man to death, replacing the fingers with your little workbench, screwing it all back together and sending it off down the line, at which point if you've made a mistake, it comes back to you. Or if not, you get a bit of money and you move on with your day trying to earn more money. And then you get things like people come along and say, I used to be a bad person, I'm not anymore. Can you disarm my arm? And so, all his fingers will be, guns and poison and stuff. You're going to take them off and replace them with proper ones. Or people might come along and say that they're a sculptor, in which case you've got to replace their regular fingers with sculpting tools and got to change the transistors in the CPU in order to get the right settings for precision and grip, which are two ratings that every hand can have. And so basically it's kind of a mixture between Papers, Please and Cook, Serve, Delicious, the game I talked about before where you're kind of making meals by combining ingredients. It's that kind of tactile feeling of manipulating an object and the satisfaction of following a pattern correctly in order to complete it. And then also just little nice bits of story in terms of the very, very simple little lines that people come and tell you and say, I tried to punch my way through a wall. And now my hand's broken. And I love that sense of being this very unusual role within a kind of Deus Ex-style world.
Yeah.
Can you set the hand to evil so that it strangles himself if you think he's done wrong?
Unfortunately not. But it seems like this was a thing that was made in, I guess, a weekend for the Cyberpunk Game Jam, or a week or something like that. I'm not sure how long a period they had to make stuff. But it seems like an idea that's rife with potential. I really hope that... the guy who made it, I don't know what his real name, but on the internet he goes by Rezoner. I really hope he expands it in a bunch of ways, because it's super cool, free, and runs in your browser.
Hmm. Is there a meta game like there is in Papers, Please, where you have to kind of earn money? I mean, what happens if you fail in this game?
I haven't encountered a full-on failure state. I'm not sure if there is one. If you screw up a hand, then you just comes back with a knot attached to say what you screwed up about it.
It strangled me.
I'm dead now. And you have to fix it and send it on its way. And there is above your workbench, there's a shelf with a radio that you can press to start playing futuristic tunes and stuff like that. But there is also a little stack of money that counts up for each day. And there's a timer, basically, that runs out. So your challenge is to see how many hands you can repair in a single day. But there doesn't seem to be any greater meta game to it than that. I'm not sure, what would the meta game be? Papers, Please, obviously, you've got family and stuff like that. What would be the cyberpunk equivalent?
How many lives can you ruin with transhumanism?
Yeah. Different factions trying to muscle in your hand repairing business.
muscle in your hand job. Set the masturbation cycle to infinite. Wank a man to death.
Oh, no. His own hands. It's like the worst Hitman game.
Terrible B movie waiting to happen.
It's a terrible accident.
None of these are genuine suggestions.
We never see that in patch notes.
The guy who made it is obviously
Sorry.
Sorry, keep going.
The guy who made it is obviously super talented, because as well, like, he programmed it, designed it, did the art, and he also did the music. So I looked him up on SoundCloud, because he's got a page there. He's also doing music for an imagined sequel to the Lotus series of racing games. So he's done, like, main title music to Lotus 4.
Wow, cool.
Which, you know, I used to play those games on the media. So basically this guy's, you know, my favourite app.
Game jams are fucking amazing. Like, yeah. I mean, it's really the standard of applicants has shot up so dramatically. I remember when I first became aware of Ludum Dare. Is it Ludum Dare?
Yeah.
Which was, I don't know, what, 5-6 years ago maybe now? And they were kind of like just joke games. None of them really worked, but you could click on a few things and maybe a picture of Thomas the Tank Engine would spiral out of the screen or something. And, you know, pink flashing text would be superimposed over it. You know, daft stuff. And now, like, the stuff you get out of them, out of a weekend's effort, is just phenomenal kind of quality that you could easily sell those games. Like, the stuff that's been coming out of the one this weekend, I forget which number, is it 39, Ludum Dare? Or is it 29?
29.
Which is, the theme is Beneath the Surface. And the stuff that's coming out of that is just crazy good.
Do you think it's because game-making tools are more accessible and better?
Yeah, I also think it's probably just there's... Oh, it's a mixture of that and talent being drawn to it now.
Mm.
Like, I mean, there just wasn't a market for this stuff. Yeah. And now, actually, this is a really good way to kind of forge a team and create an idea and, you know, get it noticed.
The 7-day FPS jam is also amazing.
Like, yeah.
The stuff that's come out of that has just generally tweaked things about the genre that I couldn't even have imagined.
Receiver, which we've talked about a bunch of times, was a 7-day FPS.
Super hot.
Was that? Yeah, that's 7-day FPS. Yeah. Awesome jam.
Yeah. I mean, games have always benefited from fast iteration, and game jams are a really great form of that when the talent is there to make that iteration worthwhile, and it's really nice seeing it kind of, you know, bear fruit instantly.
I remember Tom talking about it, and he said that it kind of really focuses you on what's important about a game, because you can't, all the big fancy long-term ideas you have about a game, you just can't afford to do. So you have to strip it back to the core idea, which is actually a very valuable process anyway, because you strip it back to the, you know, making the, editing the hand really tactile, really fun, removing panels, and that's actually an important part of that game. That's what gets made, and that's what sells it to people, and that you know if the core of your idea is good or not.
It does kind of, I think, compel you towards unusual high concepts as well, because like if you want to make a cyberpunk game, you don't have the time in order to make something Deus Ex-y in any way, and all you can really do is something that, you know, takes a very particular facet of that kind of world and develop it quickly.
Also, there's a desire to stand out as well, and I think that's particularly true of 7-day FPS, where you think of FPS as one of the most repetitive genre in terms of sort of tropes and structures and things, or at least that's the sort of the view that's trotted out the most. And in a 7-day FPS format, people are encouraged, you know, people know they've got to work within this very familiar thing, so there's a deliberate attempt to create something that people haven't done before. But even in the Beneath the Surface thing, like, you know, in Ludum Dare, you don't see people then subsequently go, oh, Beneath the Surface, I'm going to make Manic Miner, because that's technically an answer to the problem. That's not really the point. It's like, how do we creatively interpret or deliberately misinterpret this brief to create something new?
Yeah, there's such a thing, competitiveness. Positive competitiveness.
Yeah, it's positive. It's the opposite of the kind of competitiveness you normally see, which is how do we make a version of what that guy just made? Which is, you know, big publisher competitiveness. Yeah. Well, that was successful. We need one of
how
them.
How can we take this to market on the iPhone quicker than the people who originally made it?
Yeah, exactly. Whereas, like, jam competitiveness is, like, just trying to...
Jam.
Out jam each other.
Jam harder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jam to...
Jam harder.
Yeah.
Jammery. Tokyo jam.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. it's actually quite a hard thing when you come across a game, because some of them just look amazing. There's, I forget the name of it, but there's this one where I only saw a YouTube clip of it. The idea is that you lure people who are sitting on this kind of scaffolding above an ocean. You're a kind of like ghost creature that lives under the sea, like Davy Jones kind of spirit or something like that. And you have to lure them to their deaths by drowning them. And it just looks astonishing. Like, I don't think I could animate that ghost over the course of a week, let alone that and all the rest of it in a weekend. But I was quite
quite pleased to see that it seems like all you can do is go up and talk to people and little text boxes appear. I was like, phew, thank God. Thank God there isn't like an amazing mechanic in this game as well, otherwise I would have lost my shit.
It's a little bit like, I mean, it's also nice that I played Our God Lives Underground, which is...
Oh yeah, that's... Yeah, again, similar. It looks fucking
astonishing. Looks fucking amazing. I mean, it's a game that you don't do very much in. It's more about the atmosphere and a few visual effects and a style. It feels more like a sort of proof of concept for an art style for a really atmospheric dungeon exploration game or something like that, that obviously doesn't do much game-wise. But that's a nice... It's nice that you can just donate a weekend to creating something that people won't have seen before and then, you know, easily proliferating it in a way that it then can then be picked up.
I can segue. Can I segue? Are you done with your limbs finished?
Everyone should play completed. Limbs. But yes, I'm done with my
hand job. Then I shall segue freely and care freely. To another game, which is, I don't know if it originally came out of Jam, but, it is, it's also an a sensory experiential thing. Fract!
Fract called. OSC, is this on Fract OSC?
Yeah, yes, as far as I know. Which I think I feel like I've, it's been around for the entire duration of human existence. I seem to remember.
It was on Greenlight or long time ago.
I've seen it before then. When it
yeah,
was
and then even before like, then it was like, yeah.
But I think I've seen it like at every stage of its life, when it was the kind of the first thing that they ever produced for it, which was this kind of this little, it's not really a tech demo, but like a proof of concept of just this weird, alarming sensory experience and world that you can explore in first person with these weird kind of machines in it that you could interact with, and you didn't really understand what you were meant to do with these things, but as you kind of poked little bits of it, they kind of started doing stuff, and you could, work out that they started making sounds and stuff, and then you worked out that you could progress in a certain way by kind of solving these machines, essentially. And it was a really kind of weird and extremely curious, experience. I really liked it for that. And then I played it again at another IGF build, maybe a year later, maybe 2 years later. And it had become a lot more kind of more like a guided puzzle experience, but, one which was quite, which had lost some of the kind of majesty of its weirdness, you know, it felt a bit more guided, but also, but it fell between the two stools, so it was still kind of obtuse in a way that things can be cryptic, but there was a goal at the end of it which was more clear, and the fact that it was difficult to work out so suddenly become frustrating. Like, there's an interesting path that game takes between how you make kind of puzzles feel frictionless or frustrating. Because sometimes you can, it's the difference between being frustrated by a problem and being mystified by a puzzle. Like, the two experiences are probably quite similar. But I don't know if, has there been any writing about why puzzles are enjoyable and how they're different, like, emotionally from solving a problem? I don't know if there has been about games. There's lots of stuff about puzzle design, but not really specifically about the kind of emotional
response to it. A lot of it, for me, is like what mood I'm in when I'm actually sat at my PC. If it is, it's how much patience I have. It completely changes that experience. Like, a frustrating puzzle becomes something really interesting that I want to solve. I want to sit there for an hour. But if I'm just in a different mood, then it becomes that frustrating. Just get me the answer. Just fucking get me to the truth. You know, which is why I've stopped playing adventure games.
I'm not sure this is the whole answer to that, or if it would be necessarily the case in every scenario. But could it be a bit about your implicit relationship with the designer? That a puzzle is something that you feel like has been laid in front of you to solve, whereas a problem is something that has happened to you.
Yeah, a problem that doesn't want you to solve it, necessarily. Like, a problem is does not care about you. Whereas a puzzle has been designed specifically so that it presents its solution to you with a sufficient amount of kind of inspection. And I didn't feel that the game is particularly sensitive to the way that I would investigate its problems. And finally, it's been released on Steam following Greenlight. I've now seen it in its kind of third iteration, where it's actually kind of become a bit more user-friendly. It's still a much more kind of guided, not a guided experience, but it's still a much more kind of obviously a puzzle game structure to it that's been superimposed on it. And I do, I think the first couple of hours in that world are astonishing, because it is this really kind of unique sensory experience. And although it looks a bit like Tron, you know, it's got lots of kind of neon, high contrast world, very polygonal, it doesn't feel like Tron. Like, Tron's very much rooted in the kind of ideas of circuitry and urbanity and technology. And actually, despite the fact that, you know, it's got kind of lots of digital kind of aesthetic to it, in that it's polygonal and, you know, and so forth, it actually feels much more kind of organic. Like, this is a weird sort of, you know, what's the word for it? Prehistoric? Not prehistoric.
Primeval.
Primeval! There you go. Like a weird primeval cave full of some kind of arcane machinery that's been passed down by the gods. And you're somehow, you're not meant to be interacting with this stuff because it's beyond your comprehension. But you are. And unfortunately, when you come to the point that you've solved the puzzles and you've worked out how to interact with them, that mystery just disappears. Mm. And you realize that two of the main ways that you solve puzzles in that game, because there's like three big sections to it, and two of them share very similar mechanics, and they're basically Pipe Mania. And that is, although getting to the point where you realize they're Pipe Mania is quite, you know, just delightful, in the same way that a lot of games that present mystery to you are delightful in a kind of aesthetic sense. Once you get to that point, it just, you know, oh. Yeah. I don't know. They have their own twists on it. And there is an interesting escalation there to some degree. But I get the feeling that the guy produced this really interesting experience and then felt like he had to hammer that into a game.
Mm.
And that process has not necessarily been easy for him. Or them, because it's a team, actually.
How far through the game, like how many hours before you grok? That is basically just Pipe Mania.
Well, it depends, because it's an open world, and you can go through its different... I mean, some of it's gated to a degree by your progress with puzzles, but there's three main areas you can go to. And the entire thing is like an analogy for synthesized music. Like, it's also a synth.
Yeah.
And as you solve the puzzles, they build up sound and music. So you go through the world. And so one of the areas is like bass, one of them's pad, and one of them's lead. And you can approach those in any particular order. I think bass is the most interesting, or at least it's the most fun, and it feels like it's the one that was probably done, last, maybe, in that the actual geography of the world feels a bit more easy to understand, whereas, I definitely played lead way back when, which is the magenta section. And it's, the kind of geology of that place is really difficult to understand. You can easily fall off things or get caught on clipping. Mm-hmm. So it feels like it's a little less kind of well buffed. Yes. More interesting puzzles in lead though.
I do love the look of that game.
Mm.
It is, the way I describe it would be, it's like Myst. But if Myst, instead of taking place inside a magic book, took place inside a flyer for a rave.
Yeah.
Did you mess around with the studio at all?
I did a bit, but I found it quite frustrating. Like, I'm not super au fait with music making technology. You'd probably be the man to take a poke at it, I think.
Yeah, I'll look at it. It sounds really cool.
But unfortunately, you have to unlock it all first by playing the game, which is slightly annoying. But there's... I find this about a lot of games that have 3D menus and 3D interfaces, that they're just really inefficient. Like, there's a reason that a lot of music-making programs look the way they do, and they look really complicated, and they've got lots of buttons on the screen. It's because all those buttons need to fit on a single screen, so it's really quick for you to do one thing and do another thing. Whereas if you have to physically rotate your entire body in 3D space to look at a different floating menu, I don't know that that's... I mean, I guess it's more of a toy for people who are already into making synth than it is like a professional mixing desk or whatever. Not that it is mixing. Anyway, yeah. And one other thing I'd just like to say about the puzzles. Like, there's something about puzzle design that is in escalation's really important. If you're going to have the same kind of base layer to your puzzle over a succession of different puzzles, then you're going to try and escalate that. Like, the puzzle needs to be subverted in some way. You need to introduce mechanics to it which then flip your understanding of what's gone before. I think Fract is guilty of mostly just making the puzzles longer to complete. And I don't find that's very satisfactory. Like, once you've already worked out the basic mystery of it, that's Pipe Mania, then it just doesn't scintillate you when you just realise, I've got to do the same thing I did 10 minutes ago, but now it's going to take me slightly longer to do it, because there's slightly more convolutions. I don't know. Not the journey into mystery I was hoping for. I like those kind of mystery games. Like,
Would you rather, what if they just took the puzzles out and had it be a 3-hour game about going through, moving through the world?
Dear E.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. Yeah, well, actually, I mean, I know I sound down on it, but actually I really enjoyed the first 3 hours of it. Yeah. I think it's worth it. Yeah. You know, I think it's probably worth the asking price even, just to have that really unique experience of going into a world that you don't understand and feels not just alien to you, but but actually defies your understanding of just basically what you are in that world. Mm. Like, I mean, it's not like going to an alien planet where you're still a human being poking instruments that you don't understand. You just don't understand the rules of embodiment within that world. You don't understand why you're there or what it is. And that's quite an exciting dislocation.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's got a fine line, because I was playing a different game where... I can't remember the name, but I think you reviewed it for PC Gamer March, actually.
Mirror Moon?
Yeah, Mirror Moon.
I was gonna, yeah.
Which is, like, almost too abstract in the way it presents its puzzles and mysteries, and actually it just becomes annoying, because you need some grounding, like, somewhere as to, you know, what you're doing there. Mirror Moon just gives you a giant kind of a HUD that lets you point at different star systems and then puts you on a planet and where you just don't understand the rules and you have to just flap around for an hour until you find out what arbitrary thing you want you to do. Whereas it sounds like Fract gives you enough to grab onto, really, to actually pull yourself into the world.
There's a more kind of obvious reward system in Fract, or at least the success is more identifiable. Because it produces music and things start spinning and, you know, stuff. And whereas in Mirror Moon, there comes a point... I think, Mirror Moon's an amazing experience for the first few hours, particularly when you begin to understand the equipment that you've been given is a way of kind of mapping the world and working out where you are in relation to other objects. And how you use that is so exciting and non-intuitive. That's a really... interesting experience. But then after that point, there comes a point where you just really don't know whether you've run out of things to do or whether you're just missing something. And it's not giving you anything more to encourage you along a particular track. And I think I sputtered out of energy at that point, which is a shame, because there's loads of stuff to discover, apparently. But
there's another game created for a game jam originally.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Huh. Cool. Mirror Moon or
Mirror Moon.
Yeah, right. Mm. Yeah.
Good job, Jam.
Good job, Jam.
A game not created for a game jam. You've all been playing Dark Souls.
Yeah, in various iterations. Might make sense to go in almost chronological order, because I've been playing Dark Souls 1. You've been playing, Tom, Dark Souls 1 and 2.
Yeah, at the same time.
and Marsh, having watched Rich play through Dark Souls 1 and now playing Dark Souls 2.
Yes.
So, it's obviously, like, the era of Dark Souls, and that's already surprising. I mean, I am playing through Dark Souls 1 now, because Dark Souls 2 is out, and I feel the need to finally commit time to it. I mean, I played about 14 hours of the game already on the PC, and got substantially further than I am currently. But I have I quit that run, and I've restarted on 360, because I am... very concerned about what's going to happen to that game when Games Windows Live shuts down later in the year, which is the major thing hanging over at the moment. And possibly the thing to preface everything with, which is that as good as these games are, and as tempting as it might be to pick up Dark Souls 1 cheap on Steam now, no one knows if it's going to work in 2 months.
It doesn't even particularly work well now. Like, I mean, the number of connection fails you have is just ridiculous. It
runs like shit as well. Like, it really does.
Like, I mean, it runs like shit a little bit on the Xbox as well, when the particle effects start to go, but, like, the fact they didn't even fix that on the PC, like, it's not a good port. So that's the downside. So I ended up restarting because the Xbox version is, you know, pretty much guaranteed to still work, and actually, it does still have an active, online scene. Like, I found it very easy to find people to summon in. haven't been invaded yet, but I did a boss with someone else helping, so that was good. And I think I've got two things to take away from it that maybe don't just retread things that have been said about Dark Souls 1 a million times before. One is that I think I realised why I bounced off it twice before. Like, I started playing on Xbox when it came out, and I started playing on PC when it came out, and this is the first time I've sort of felt this compulsion to go back to it reliably. And I think it's because it's... Well, for me, when I'm playing an RPG, I play them in long sessions. That tends to be the thing that defines RPGs for me in terms of the amount of time they take up. They're probably the single-player games I'll spend the most time with, but I'll do it in, like, weekends, which we've spoken before with Skyrim, where it takes over all of that time. And if something like a BioWare game, I'll play that in long sessions, like, you know, a whole evening given over to a particular storyline or something. You know, I want to see a particular arc through in the time you sit down to play it. And even games like Diablo, which are not narrative but numbers-based, they break down into sort of like long, multiple-hour sessions of running a particular set of dungeons or doing this or that and the other. And actually, I don't think, at least for me, that's the best way to play Dark Souls. Like, Dark Souls, in its structure, your progress is basically measured by bonfires, shortcuts, and bosses. And pretty much guaranteed that every half an hour you will run into, if not clear, one of those things. And so progress through the game, even though it's a very long game, is quite easily broken down into sort of digestible chunks. And I feel like I've gotten my measure of Dark Souls for the day out of the way just by beating one of those things. And it's actually quite a good way of avoiding being frustrated with it, but also quite a satisfying way of playing RPGs I'd never really done before, which is just like, I'm going to boot up this game and I'm going to get my character over the next hill and then find a safe place to stop and then I'm going to continue tomorrow. And I'm finding that much more satisfying than the previous way I was trying to do it, which is like, I think if you extend too much time to over a long period of time, those sort of peaks and troughs of its difficulty and everything else starts to get quite exhausting. Like, you're constantly like facing another peak, and then you get your respite periods feel less good because you're sort of, you know, just sort of, you know, clearing the decks for the next boss fight you're going to have to do and stuff like that. Whereas playing it more like a sort of episodic thing, I find more satisfying. The other thing that has really struck out to me this time is, as many issues as there are with the very particular sort of, not really issues, but the idiosyncrasies of the combat system and the way its animations work, and, you know, the way damage is sort of, the points at which damage is calculated in a blow, not necessarily feeling 100% intuitive straight away. You know, determining the exact positioning for backstabs and things like that, it takes a while to feel intuitive, rather than it just being sort of an arbitrary window the game wants you to hit. It is actually quite a good analog feeling swordplay game.
Yeah.
Which there are very few of, because most swordplay games or games with swords in them feel incredibly either very digital in one way or another. They're either digital in the sense that your sword is just really like a stick that you wave to remove numbers from a number box, and when the number box runs out of numbers, the number box drops a potion for you to pick up. Like, it's, you know, it's incredibly lifeless in that way. Or it's, you know, oh, you've been hit by the sword at all, you know, there's no gradation of sort of meaning or subtlety in that, it's just happened. And the thing that starts with Dark Souls, not just the fact that the way you swing your sword and the exact sort of parameters of that swing is important, but because it's basically a sword and shield game, you know, you can play with two-handed weapons and stuff, but I think most players will start out with something in their hand and a shield. That adds a manageable binary element to what's quite an analog experience, which is probably the perfect breakdown for swords in a video game. Trying to do like proper sword playing games is very, very, very difficult, because sword play is defined by very small movements that are very hard to replicate at any level in games. Very few, you know, sword fighting happens in the wrist. It does not happen at the end of the blade. And the thing that the reason basically no game ever has done decent sword play is because you don't move the end of the blade, which is the point where the player is normally looking, and the point that's the most obvious in all of the animations, you move the hilt. Like, in almost all forms of, like, swordplay, that's the most important bit, because it's the point of most force. The way you balance that, I think, in a game is by adding the sort of sword and shield into play, which is what Dark Souls does very well, where hitting a shield means one thing, hitting a shield into a parry means another thing, and the sort of the way that staggers and stuff are calculated against stamina and the rest of that sort of resource management that happens literally behind the shield as two players are sort of facing off each other and trying to determine the right way to break each other's defenses is gamey enough to function as a game, but feels real enough when you're doing it that you're not lost in the systems. You know what I mean? You are thinking about catching your breath by dropping your shield for a second, or even trying to bait an incoming attack, or even like hitting once to fake out, like hitting once to sort of make it look like you're going to leave yourself open, but then like cancelling the second attack into a block. Like that kind of thing feels way more like sword fighting to me than normally would. The other thing that I noticed is that game is right-handed. Because your character is right-handed, and because sword play is quite, as I said, analog, a lot of the environments are balanced to be approached right-handed. It is easier to fight around a left-hand turn than a right-hand turn in Dark Souls, because if you're fighting around a right, like with a weapon that does not thrust, thrusting weapons don't have this problem, but a weapon that swings from the elbow or the shoulder, where you're swinging very strongly from the right around to the left.
Yeah, I think that's true in the sequel as well.
Yeah, so it is like an environment that curves to the left, which I quite a lot of them seem to.
Well, they do all double back on themselves eventually, so going keep on going.
You move anti-clockwise, like because I realised this because there's an early boss called the Capra Demon that's sort of notoriously difficult, and there's the main way to get to him from a shortcut involves quite a lot of fighting. It's shorter, but it's the bonfire sort of takes you left and around down some stairs, and then left again through the lower part of the undead burg in a straight line to his place. If you go a different way at the bottom of the undead burg where his white mist gate is, you can unlock the shortcut back to Firelink Shrine, which is the hub, through the aqueduct, which is a quicker route to him. It's a longer route, but it's got far less fighting on the way, so if you're having trouble with the boss, I prefer to respawn at Firelink and run back that way. But that way, coming back that way, is doing the game backwards a little bit. So there's suddenly a lot of there's a lot of awkward right-hand turns.
Huh.
Particularly as you're coming back out of the aqueduct towards Firelink. And there's a guy who's actually quite hard to fight, even though he's one of the shittiest little hollow infantry rubbish men in the game. I find, without using the longsword heavy attack, which is a thrust, because he comes at you on a very narrow ledge from your right-hand side, and you can't swing at him because there's a wall in the way. And there's not an especially deep observation, but it's something I picked up.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't think the environments... when I said that's true of Dark Souls 2, I think that what I meant is that it's a right-handed game in that your weapons tend to swing from the right to the left. But I don't think the environments are designed that way particularly. They seem a lot less... I mean, Dark Souls 1 is all built on a tree. So there's a kind of obvious reason that you'd be spiraling around it, and everything is kind of vertical and positioned above each other. So you don't want the levels to go off in one particular direction. You want to be constantly looping around. So there's structural reasons why it would be advantageous to have constant left turns, whereas Dark Souls 2, things spread out and they go off in different directions for a long, long direction. There doesn't seem to be... Not as much looping round, really?
No, it's interesting, because it's almost like a hub-and-spoke kind of layout to Dark Souls 2, which is quite a big break from a lot of Dark Souls aficionados really enjoyed how interlinked Dark Souls 1, how knotted it was, There are so many ways from any area into any other area. It's almost as though, like, Firelink is at the heart of the game, but almost every place is a hub from which you can get to at least two other locations normally. Whereas in Dark Souls 2, there's a lot of kind of knotted design and kind of shortcut stuff within the spokes, but you're teleporting back to this very clear, like Majula, which is at the centre of the game, is a very clear hub location in this one, which is quite a big change. But yeah, there's less of that spiralling, though you can dual wield in Dark Souls 2, so if you're wielding two weapons, you can't swing from the left. I have noticed that there's a big, hitting walls is a big deal in Dark Souls, especially in Dark Souls 2. So they've changed the way that your weapons are damaged. They damage much more easily, but they repair at bonfires now. But if you're in a really long bonfire-to-bonfire kind of fight, then your weapon can snap, or you can get close to snapping and have to swap it out. And that a lot of that is denoted by, like, if you hit a wall, it does extra damage to your weapon, because it's hard surface, it blunts it. And it's really interesting how they've just used statues in that game to just make swinging awkward without hitting the walls. Like, it encourages even more precision. And I'm using a longsword in Dark Souls 2 as opposed to a club in Dark Souls 1. So I absolutely love the thrust animation. If you wield it two-handed, you can press, like, Y at any point, like, a button at any point, to just put your shield on your back and just hold your weapon in two hands. And that changes the moveset you have and increases the damage, and it just changes the way you fight. And one of the things I love about Dark Souls is that you can kind of, you can see an enemy coming at you, and you go, okay, I know this guy, I know how to deal with it, I'm going to put the shield on my back, I'm going to use this strategy. And you're constantly changing up between the two. And the way that they play statues just kind of encourages you to sometimes just go double-handed and thrust through statues to keep your weapon intact.
Hmm.
And just, I love the depth to the combat system, that is a consideration you're making. Like, your weapon is such a physical presence in that world that it can become damaged. And its precise angle and swipe denotes whether you do damage or not. Because if you, like, a reason why it kind of feels bullshit at first is because you expect, you know, character hitboxes and weapon hitboxes in games tend to be so generous that you expect a vague swipe at an enemy to always hit.
Mm.
Whereas in Dark Souls, if that blade didn't touch the enemy, it's not going to do any damage. So you're not getting the kind of default damage you expect.
But yeah.
As soon as you start, as you understand how it actually works, it becomes a fantastic fighting game.
I think I don't necessarily want to argue that, like, Dark Souls is designed to be a left-hand spiral for that specific reason.
Oh, yeah.
But what I would suspect is when you're designing an area and testing areas, the areas that would instinctively feel wrong in either the... I mean, obviously in Dark Souls 2, it takes it to a more mechanical extreme in terms of incorporating it into the mechanics of the game. But the ones... In Dark Souls 1, when you're fighting to the right, it starts to feel slightly off or more sort of... the rhythm seems wrong because you're constantly hitting the wall. Mm. And that's... You know, that's, I think that would be apparent in testing the game, and that's why I think it's probably had an influence on the way the game is shaped, because that would come across even subconsciously, that this environment feels unfriendly somehow, and it's because it's angling me in my vulnerable direction rather than my strong direction, which is just an interesting intersection of combat and environment design.
Mm. It's been really interesting playing Dark Souls 2, where I think there are far more humanoid enemies. I think you fight a lot more bipedal things with weapons than you do in Dark Souls 1. I've been to a lot of areas in Dark Souls 2 now. I think I've been to most of them. You don't encounter quite as much completely weird shit as you do in Dark Souls 1. So in Sense Fortress in Dark Souls 1, I've made fun of the weird lizard men you find there, where they just look like men with giant snakes growing out of their heads. But I miss it in Dark Souls 2. I miss that weird shit. I miss the basilisks, like that kind of monster design.
I wouldn't miss the basilisks. having just got rid of that fucking curse, yeah. Fuck basilisks.
Yeah, I hate those things. But that the weird is their design, and like the gaping dragon in Dark Souls 1 is this amazing piece of monster design in this enormous arena.
Yeah, actually, I mean, I really the majority of boss fights in Dark Souls 1 are with monsters, whereas probably the minority in Dark Souls 2. I think most of the bosses I've encountered so far have been
humanoids, really.
Yeah, humanoids.
With a similar skill set to you.
Which is exciting. I mean, I always found those fights in Dark Souls 1 to be the most enjoyable. You know, by proxy, obviously, I wasn't playing. I was watching Rich Stanton play for me.
Yeah, but,
yeah, like, the fight with Artorias in Dark Souls 1 is fantastic because you feel like you're fighting a mighty swordsman who is, like, really fast with his blade, and you're kind of dodging out of the way and counter-attacking. Mm. And that is a more exciting fight than hacking at the Achilles heel of a dragon. And
yeah.
Kind of, like, circling it.
Well, a lot of those monster fights are all... They're quite similar.
Mm.
Like, the environments make a big difference, but, like, dodge the horizontal... Roll laterally under the horizontal swipe.
Yeah.
Hit the bum. Back off.
Yeah. There's a lot of bums. Yeah. There's
a lot of poking bums.
A lot of poking bums.
Chopping tails off.
Yeah. I would say the pace of Dark Souls 2... I suppose we should talk about the relative difficulty of these games. That's the thing that is always mentioned. But the pace of Dark Souls 2, I mean, you're saying that you like to play it in small bursts. I think Dark Souls 2 really lends itself to that in a way that Dark Souls 1 didn't always, because it wasn't as generous with its shortcuts or wasn't as generous with its bonfires. Whereas Dark Souls 2 seems to be, so far anyway, maybe it becomes grueling later on, but I think pretty much you can rely on turning up a shortcut or another bonfire within 20 minutes of play, if not 15. Obviously you have to know where you're going, so it can take some number of excursions before you work out the correct path back. I'm using a weapon which degrades really quickly, so I find that if I spend too much time tutting about and exploring, then it breaks before I can get back to a bonfire. So it's kind of quite regimented in that way.
Yeah, I've taken to carrying a second weapon that I use as a backup weapon.
I only like one weapon, though. Yeah, I know, yeah. I just need to level up so I can use it.
What weapon are you using?
It's one of the DLC weapons. It's called some quartz thing. But I've leveled it up now, so it's better than everything else.
Because the movesets are so different in Dark Souls. It's another thing that really interests me about its combat. Is that a rapier just behaves completely differently to a longsword, and again to a shortsword, and again to a club, and again to, you know, a halberd. And all the fighting styles have their own massive flaws. So I love the club in Dark Souls 1. I played the entire game so far with just the first club I found, because it's got a massive lunging overhead attack.
Oh, yeah.
That lets you can back off and then actually interrupts a lot of attack animations with that, and it's really effective, especially, and it staggers really easily as well, because it's a big strength weapon. Whereas in Dark Souls 2, they just subtly change the animation of how it attacks and how it works, and I was just like, fuck this, I can't use this anymore, this is not how I can't fight with this weapon. But there's so much finesse to the movesets, and like the fact that range is so important, and the fact that interrupt and destabilizing enemies is so important, that I've gravitated towards a longsword as opposed to a club. And that is fucking awesome.
I love the longsword in Dark Souls 1. I'm still using the first longsword I found.
I think it's quite similar, the moveset between...
Yeah, two. I like sword fighting. And I like the way it feels as a sort of a good balanced, like, sort of versatile weapon. And its power attack is a thrust, which it doesn't have normally. What?
Oh, it's, no, nothing. I was just feeling sorry for Graham.
Fine. Join the chat.
Like, its power attack is this thrust that does genuinely feel like slightly overextending, and that's a nice balance of, like, your comfort zone is sort of like shield up, swinging laterally to try and, like, zone out opponents and sort of establish safe space, and then you have this, like, killer sort of thrust that you only use when you're feeling really, really confident, and the jumping downward stab on the longsword is
that's really good.
Fucking great as well.
You can chain the long thrusts together if you've got loads of endurance, it's good.
Best way of killing those goo things that are completely bullshit otherwise.
But yeah, you're right, Marge. Apart from in a couple of locations, there's an equivalent of Blighttown in Dark Souls 2, which is fucking horrible and extremely dark, and it's extremely long time before you find one by there, but more or less, it does seem much easier. And Dark Souls 2 is less of a dick than Dark Souls 1, in that, you know, in Sense Fortress, they just hide the bonfire in a place where you're just not going to find that unless you've read a wiki, you know. And Dark Souls 2 is kinder in that way. It's just, you know, they're going to give you that bonfire every time, every 20 minutes.
Lots of helpful advice as well, I found. Loads and loads of messages, which I wasn't experienced playing it with Rich on PC, Dark Souls 1 on PC. There's almost no messages left by people, whereas
they're quite abundant on the 360, which is nice.
I guess there are a lot of people playing through it. Just before the sequel's out, so maybe that's why it's...
A lot of troll messages as well, but...
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
try jumping!
Yes!
My favourite one...
Liar ahead.
Yeah.
I always upvote those.
My favourite is Illusory Wall.
That's really... That's a real cunt in the second one. Because your weapon breaks with
Exactly. So every wall in the game has Illusory Wall in front of it. Just trying to get people pointlessly...
But in Dark Souls 2, you don't hit walls to open them.
Exactly. I didn't realize
until a long time. But there are people are trolling by putting the illusory wall message so close to the wall that, because you have to press A to activate them now. Press A is also the read message button.
Oh, yeah.
And if it's so close to the wall, and it must be a deliberate troll because I've seen it everywhere, you read the message and you can't ever access the treasure.
Then you press Y to cycle between interactions.
No, you can't in that instance, yeah.
There's it's not even a mini boss, but like a tough character that is best taken down by firing ballistas at him. But somebody had gone around and placed a fucking comet in front of every single ballista's control, so you had to go up to it, press A, then toggle between the messages, and then, asshole.
I love the
good, clever asshole. I'm going to admire his
top trolling.
Yeah,
top trolling. It's a brilliant. I think that's a brilliant message in Dark Souls 2, because there's been such a sense of community, even though you rarely directly interact with other players in that game. You leave messages for each other on the floor, and they sometimes appear in other people's worlds. And there's just like running jokes that have started among the community, where there's one which is the message "Hurrah for Boulder" in front of big rocks at random locations. Just wherever there's a big rock, someone scrolls "Hurrah for Boulder" and 200 likes, 200 comments for that. And there's another one where like there are corpses everywhere, of course, in Dark Souls, and there are like skeletal corpses. And there's a message which is "Sadness." But hurrah for skeleton! That always gets like dozens of votes, but I suppose leave that as well. I just love that people can make jokes in this world. It's supposedly horrible world. It's sort of a sense of humour there.
Yeah, I wonder, do you think that, there's a lot of the people who played Dark Souls 1 initially and the biggest advocates of that feel quite disappointed by Dark Souls 2. Mm. I wonder if there's something about having that very overt community aspect. And the fact that it's now become a thing that produces memes and appears on Reddit and stuff like that, whether that has kind of taken away some of the first game's kind of...
They liked it before mystery. It was cool.
I know, that is it.
But there is something to that.
Actual reaction people have, right? Yeah. That's not an untrue emotion.
There's an irony to it, but like it is still more or less legitimate as a reason they like you to like something.
I also do think, though, that you maybe there are some certain elements about Dark Souls 1, particularly all the lore aspects and the fact that the lore and the mechanics are very cleverly intertwined. You can't really just bottle that lightning and set it again in a slightly different form. You can't really just improve those mechanics in the way that Dark Souls, I think, does, because then you've actually changed the meaning. And I don't know if it's going to... it's lost that meaning. It's become a game more enjoyable for its mechanics than anything else.
Can I make a comparison that is caveated by the fact that I haven't finished Dark Souls 1 and haven't played Dark Souls 2? Reminds me of Bioshock 2.
Yeah, but there is that.
Bioshock 1 was the one that had the sort of self-contained narrative that linked its narrative to its mechanics and all the rest of it. And Bioshock 2 was the one that couldn't really pull that trick again. So it couldn't answer the same philosophical problems, but did improve the mechanics in almost every possible way and was a better game, basically. Just not as important as a game, probably.
I think that's an exact comparison, actually.
Yeah, it's precisely that. I mean, the fact they've changed humanity to human effigies in the second game is a note that says that we're not really trying to say the same thing in this game. But I'm still really interested in the lore of the second game because it ties into the first game in so many quite subtle ways. And also, just the way that Dark Souls imparts its lore requires a lot of effort on the part of the player, which I actually find quite refreshing. It's all about item descriptions, mostly, and how the environments are laid out and what kind of symbology you find in those environments and where you find bosses and why they might be there. And you spin out, potential theories based on those small facts. It's just detective work. It's like you're a historian going through this ancient half-dead place and there's so few people to talk to that you can't, there are no sources. You just have to, look around yourself and piece it together.
And sources you do find often lighty.
just with alarming regularity, yeah. There's a lot of really cool narrative stuff in Dark Souls 2 where the characters, your relationship with them branches in a lot of different ways depending on whether you take them into certain boss fights, whether you keep them alive during certain boss fights, and that will affect the way they behave in future. And there are some... Yeah, it's just really interesting. I think New Game Plus in Dark Souls 2 is going to be a lot more important than New Game Plus in Dark Souls 1.
Oh, really? What do you mean? How?
In that it will give you more opportunities to find the other side of a character's story. If you've gone through and there's this untrustworthy character and you've sided with another person, you go back and side with that person, find out more about the lore, and he'll give you another angle on the story and that kind of thing. And also, there's a lot of stuff that they change in New Game Plus and Dark Souls 2, like... You can be ambushed by bosses in different locations, and there's changed a lot of the boss fights, which they did in Dark Souls 1 as well, but there's a lot more stuff for people to play through a second time.
Have you done much online stuff? I've spent quite a lot of the game undead, because I'm slightly scared of being invaded.
Yeah, so. There's a brilliant place, it's a tower that you find by unlocking a secret key, and you encounter a mad dwarf. And next to him there's a pile of dwarf corpses. And he's insane. He's just completely mad. And it's a covenant. The covenant of the bellkeepers, I think they're called. And if you have to fight your way up to the top of the tower. And it's full of tiny dwarves that invade you constantly. NPC dwarves that will invade you constantly. But if you join that covenant, you get summoned into that tower to defend the tower against people like me who's just exploring. So I was going up there on the second floor. Suddenly it says, so-and-so has been summoned. I just shat myself. I went cold all over. It's that feeling like, oh, fuck. I'm actually going to fight a real human. And the brilliant thing, my favourite moment in Dark Souls 1 and 2 so far has just been the moment where you first see each other. And you just do the standoff. You do the thing where you just kind of put the shield up and you just kind of look at what weapon they've got. And you're trying to think, okay, how's he going to attack me? Has he got any magic? Looking at the environment, going to avoid that hole there. Because the tower is full of just big holes in the floor that you can just fall through and roll through, And then you actually kind of circle each other and you do the kind of the Star Trek da 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 da. That music plays in my head whenever it happens. And then you kind of do battle, and then I killed a guy, and it was just the feeling of like the thrill of it was fucking amazing. I can't express it.
Said Jeffrey Dahmer.
Ah, oh, but yeah, he just goes vanquished, and you don't really get anything for it. But it's just seeing satisfaction of actually fighting like another human. Mm. After fighting, after just hours and hours of fighting Hollows and just predictable attack patterns, to have to like interact with this thing that is going to be watching you and trying to learn what to do, it's just a massive change of pace. That change of gear just is really exhilarating.
Seem to be a lot more kind of interesting covenants that you can join, which take you into other people's games for specific purposes. There's like a tower defense one, right? Where you are, you come in as defender for the Rat King. I haven't got that from
The Rat King is really interesting, because if you join the Rat Covenant, then again you're called to defend that realm, and it's full of kind of like traps that you can activate to poison, you know, unleash poison rivers and stuff like that. But the interesting thing about that, instead of invading someone else's world, you summon them into your world, which means that they don't know where you are. So essentially, you have complete control of the engagement. Which I've not tried doing it yet. I know Rich Stamps is a big fan of doing this, and I can kind of understand why, because imagine the thrill of like setting up the traps and actually hunting someone through that environment. It's great. I've been sucked into someone else's world.
Oh god, that was amazing. It's horrible feeling.
Terrifying. It's really scary. It's really scary because like you don't know where they are, and you're constantly rotating the camera trying to look around corners, and it's just like step by step. Of course they can hear you because they're a human, and they're not like a stupid AI that's just going to be... They've not gone to aggro radius, you know? They're going to know where you are by the speed at which you're moving. And just that kind of... That face-off is just fascinating. It's really, really good. Really interesting.
Do you ever tell the story of the first time I got invaded in Dark Souls 1?
No.
Okay.
You should.
Yeah. So this was on the PC version ages ago for my initial character. But you know, right before the Gargoyle boss, which is probably the earliest really hard boss in Dark Souls 1, so you climb up onto this roof to fight the gargoyles. Before you emerge out onto the roof, you climb a series of ladders that each leads to a kind of like narrow platform. And the top one really is just like a sort of 6-foot by 4-foot rectangle with a door out to the boss on one side and a ladder on it. And if you're human, there's a sign on the floor to summon Solaire, who's like the first NPC ally you get. And so I pressed the summoning sign, to summon him. And waited, and summoning in Dark Souls, even for NPCs, is kind of shonky. Like, it sort of takes a little while. I had never, ever summoned anybody before. Like, I never tried this. So I was sort of waiting to see what would happen. And I'm standing there, like, facing the summoning sign, just sort of waiting. And then this massive, tall, red figure appears, almost directly in front of me, with, like, this, like, wearing, like, a robe with a crown, like, a spiked crown, carrying, like, a katana and a shield. And I was like, that's not like Solaire. Like, I hadn't met Solaire. He was, like, a fat guy. Like, that's not him. And then the words, you are invaded, appeared. And that happens to, I think, would be where the invader spawn point is for that part of the world. And I'm like, oh, dicks. Like,
Did it go well?
Well, and then as the guy sort of like, the guy, you know, brought his shield up or whatever, and we had that moment, we're on this tiny ledge, Solaire appeared between us, finished his summon, and he opens his summon with this sort of like yoga pose, like he sort of just praise the sun thing, right? Like, this is Y shape. And the guy's first blow hit Solaire rather than me. And so Solaire turns around and starts sort of smacking the guy. And you could tell the other player was surprised. Like, there was an obvious moment of, I'm about to gank a newbie. You know, I'm standing there in my shitty armor with my long sword and shield or whatever. That moment of, I'm going to gank a newbie, turned into, ah, fuck, for him. And he accidentally rolled off the platform and went straight down to the, I think dropped all the way to the platform below. And then Solaire, like, jumped after him. And I just found myself alone up on the top of the platform, like, looking over the edge, angling the camera forward, watching this guy fight Solaire, like, of two floors below. But it was clear that the guy was obviously fairly high level, and it was clear that he was going to beat Solaire eventually, like, just grinding him down in a straight fight, like, just tanking and hitting him. Like, I was just watching Solaire's health bar chip down, this other guy's health bar chip down. And I was standing there, and then I realised the first thing that game teaches you, which is the drop attack. You know, for the Asylum boss at the very beginning, it teaches you to fall off a ledge and hold the attack buttons. I was like, Yeah. Anyway, okay. So I just sort of tilted myself forward off the ledge and held the button and just sort of fell two stories, my longsword pointed out, and hit the guy right in the head as I was coming down. And, like, wrecked his health bar, like, down to a tiny, tiny sliver. And he sort of, like, dodge roll, panicked away, and stood up. And then bolted in the opposite direction. And I suddenly I'm chasing him through the undead... Is it the undead church? Yeah. And so like, it's like little narrow windings of
angle.
It's
in the parish, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's in the parish. So right through the winding corridors. And I'm chasing him, and then he stops at the end of this sort of like stairwell going down, turns around, faces me, and puts the shield up. And I was just like, okay, fine, in for a penny, in for a pound. Ran at him and did the jumping attack instead of the, like, rather than stopping, just went straight into the forwards and power attack. Like, it's like a leap and then a downwards thrust. I ended up with me jumping over his shield and hitting him hard enough to kill him. And the guy sort of does his death animation and vanishes. And at that point, I was just basically like doing a knee slide across the floor in my room. Like, yes! And then he sent me a message on like through Gaze Windows Live, which was like, well, just well done, smiley face.
Aww.
And it was like, aww. It was like one of the, it was genuinely one of the best multiplayer experiences I could think of in that context.
I've had some brilliant ones with Dark Souls. And I think the fact that the game requires you to learn the levels so well, because you're going to run through those levels over and over again, you know where all the enemies are, it makes them brilliant multiplayer arenas. Because there's no, like, you're never going to encounter someone who isn't familiar with the environment, and the environment is so important in Dark Souls and how you can, you know, get ahead of someone. So you're always on an even footing in that sense, and you always know how to run away. It's really, really good. Dark Souls, it's quite good.
Praise the sun.
Praise the game for being nice, a nice game.
Sorry, Graham.
Yeah.
I'm fine. Is the port better this time around?
Yeah, way better.
Cool. Well, maybe I'll play it then. Probably not, though. Fuck you guys.
We'd say, actual plug for once, we have an amazing guy optimizing that game on PC Gamer at the moment, which was done for us by Durante, who's the modder who did the resolution fix for the first game. I would normally plug PC Gamer stuff, but that is genuinely a really, really good guide to upscaling the game, and it looks, I saw it running on a massive TV today at like 1440p. Which or whatever the one up to 1080 is, and it looked banging.
There's a curious disparity like between different areas in that game as to like is places like Majula are extremely pretty, and there are certain areas that kind of look unfinished, really underdeveloped.
It's mostly the lighting model in Majula. I don't think it's especially pretty game overall. No, yeah.
But it's kind of their impressive vista. There are places where you come out and go, this place is cool. This is interesting. Whereas I lit a primal bonfire in Dark Souls 2. I don't know what the words primal bonfire, what image you get in your mind when I say that, but it was a stone, it was a brick box with no light in it. And it was like, you go and just light a bonfire, it's like, it's a primal bonfire, it's like special bonfire. Why'd you put it, why is it in this room and this looks like something from Unreal Engine, like Unreal Engine? How's game where you just draw a box and...
Yeah, there are moments like that, like, I mean, I think fantasy would do well to wean itself off sewers, generally. Light Town's just a big sewer, really. Like, you know what I mean? And now the brown level.
Yeah.
Like,
man, it's many, many levels of brown that you go through. In fact, Dark Souls has, like, what, three, four different distinct levels of sewer? By the time you're at the bottom, you're like, you're in the runoff from the runoff from the runoff.
Yeah.
And there are men there who just throw poo at you. People and have on their personal dumpers in their inventory. Yeah.
People in Lodron can't possibly poo enough. The amount of people versus the amount of sewer.
They don't eat anything. Where's all the sewage coming from?
It kind of raises it to a sort of art form, though. Yeah. This is the kind of underpinnings of that type of world, just that it is putrid and gross.
Yeah.
Well, it's also, I don't know, to go too much on the lore side, but it does fit into the whole idea that, you know, it's the hierarchy, the gods shitting on the people below them, who are shitting on the people below them.
Who are shitting on the sewer people.
Exactly.
The irony. Who are shitting on the sub-sewer people.
Yeah. I just in the middle of writing now, playing about that descent, it's the second bell, it's where you go to the depths. And you think the depths, that's pretty deep, right?
Yeah.
It's like, that's the top layer of the 5-tier dungeon you're going down. Until you're actually just in a poison lake about to fight. It's just a fucking horrible spider thing, yeah. It's grim, but it's so oppressive that it's brilliant. I think the thing about Dark Souls is that you're an undead who, you know, just respawns whenever you die. So death isn't a problem, but giving up is how you actually lose Dark Souls. And it's despair is actually what the game is trying to beat you with. And that run down to the second bell is about just making you feel despair. It slowly takes away the light. It hits you with the basilisks. Going to Blight Town, these narrow, kind of horrible, dark kind of walkways that you fall off all the time, and you're constantly being poisoned until you're actually wading through shit. And it's like, do you want to give up now? Do you want to give up now? And it's constantly showing you these corpses with souls on them. You're picking off the souls, and they're just the souls of other undead like you. They've given up at that point. They're just lying down and died, and you've taken their souls. And it's a big theme of Dark Souls. It's supposed to be oppressive and horrible and shit.
Is it redemptive at all at the end? Like, do you end up on a beach somewhere and Morgan Freeman comes along, or is it just
he hid the final souls under a tree?
No,
not really redemptive. I wouldn't say it's a very interesting ending, and it can go different ways. But I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah,
it would be a shame. If you're interested, you can watch our final episode of our playthrough on our YouTube channel.
Yeah, it's good. The redemption in that game is going back to Firelink and being in the sun again and hearing that beautiful kind of melancholy string music play and just being like, oh, fuck, I did it. It's fine.
It's going to sit on the log in Firelink forever.
Stay here, sit down. Yeah.
Shall we do questions?
Let's do questions.
Let's answer questions.
From
the internet questions.
Yep, that's where they come from and what they are. Richard asks, sending this one again, especially since last week Mirror's Edge was mentioned as having bits which could have been removed in a director's cut. And so he refers to a couple of episodes ago, but obviously this email was originally sent in the past, where we talked about how the start of Rage ruined the whole experience for me, and how I couldn't get past the opening of Mass Effect because the combat was so bad. And he goes on to ask, why do you think developers don't do special editions or director's cuts or simply second attempts to fix games which have only got middling scores first time around in an attempt to draw more of an audience? It would seem reasonable that if you've spent 3 to 4 years working on a title and the biggest problem people have with it is the combat, that you'd actually spend a few weeks or months and make the combat better and re-release it, especially if you spent a lot of money doing so, making the game in the first place.
Profit probably comes into it at some point.
Marketing is probably the biggest issue in that when a game is out and its critical scores are in,
that's it.
That's kind of it for that game's identity, and doing a re-release, it does happen sometimes, but like when it doesn't, I suspect it's because essentially re-releasing the quote-unquote same product is much harder to easily communicate to people than a sequel, for example. And so as a result, it becomes more difficult for developers to do. Specifically, one issue with this, you may have mentioned before, but comes up quite a lot for us, I think professionally, is that when a score has been given for a game, Metacritic will take that as your score forever. And if you change the score for whatever reason or re-review the game, they won't change it. So it doesn't, like, for the vast majority of people who use a critical aggregator like that to find out how good the game is, it doesn't matter if the developer fixes it and then you re-review it, because the only score that ever matters is the first one, which is bullshit, but that's the way things are.
I guess Final Fantasy XIV is an interesting example where they spent years and a lot of money revamping it and trying to make it a success. And the amount of just raw PR they had to do, the amount of time they had to put developers in front of people and have developers throw their hands up and go, we made mistakes, it was bad, we fixed it, we know what's wrong with it now. Like, the amount of time it took them to try and wrench that around is beyond most companies' patience and capacity, I think.
I imagine Deus Ex Human Revolution wouldn't have got its director's cut if it wasn't re-releasing on another platform as well.
Yeah.
I mean, although I don't think the platform sales for the Wii U were particularly profitable for them in the end. I imagine that was the only reason they were able to sell that idea to their higher-ups.
I suspect in Final Fantasy XIV's case, the reason it happened was because it's such an important brand for Square Enix. Like, it's this, even though they've been making slightly dumb Final Fantasy games for years, it's the one series where they're not really allowed a failure. Like, you know, all of the games sell well, but especially a critical failure on the magnitude of the initial Final Fantasy XIV, like, they have to fix it. And because it is the lifeblood of their company. Whereas most of the time, I think, you know, especially when you talk about big publishers working with smaller studios on individual products, it doesn't do well on release. Sorry, your studio's closed now. Bye. Like, or you've all been reassigned to a different project. There's no one left to do that director's cut.
Cut your losses.
Yeah.
I think maybe it happens more than we're thinking it does, though. Like, it used to happen a lot in the kind of shitty internet age when you would get Game of the Year editions for games, where you know, if most users, players couldn't download the patches, and so they would just bundle a year's worth of patches together and re-release the game as the Game of the Year edition. That was sort of the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think now that games have a longer tail because of digital distribution, you do see it. So like The Witcher had enhanced editions, so did The Witcher 2, in fact, that kind of came out a year after release and fixed a bunch of bugs, added a bunch of new content, changed a bunch of voice acting and stuff like that.
I think that is a case of like a company with one game that is their identity, and that everything relies on that, and they're building trust with their customers. They want people to come back to the next game.
It's also easier to market a fix for bugs than it is a fix for kind of intractable mechanical problems with your game. Like, if you don't enjoy the combat in your game, it's hard for somebody to convince you, oh yeah, we've made the combat super enjoyable for you now. Whereas, you know, we've stopped panthers levitating is probably something that's more easily kind of sellable.
I think there is a line there, but like, it seems like it's harder with something like Final Fantasy, where it was really shit the first time around to convince people that it's good now. But if you've released a good game, like Deus Ex Human Revolution with the boss fight, say, it's a really good game, but there's just one thing that people fucking hate.
Yeah.
Maybe combat's not the best example, but he also mentions the driving controls in GTA 4, which I liked.
Yeah, I love those.
A lot of reviews did criticize it for that.
Yeah, they were wrong about that.
And that would be a thing that would be easier to tweak than, you know.
I don't know that it would, actually. Like, this entire city is designed around your ability to corner or not corner on certain things. Like, I mean, they did roads aren't just thrown into games. Like, they are. They are considered based on the actual driving. What's the word? Fucking hell.
Model physics.
Model! There you go, Jesus. The driving model Jesus.
Driving model Jesus. Because they're driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah, sequel.
Very. I was going to say, like, another example of this would be Blue Shift for Half-Life 1, which changed the engine and redid all of the graphics for the game as a whole, which it created this kind of, like, interesting upgrade to make Half-Life 1 fresh again. There's been, I think it was today, there were rumours of, like, boxes. You know how sometimes things get listed on Amazon too early or whatever? For the entire Mass Effect trilogy on next-gen consoles in a single box. And it will be, obviously, I don't think BioWare have the resources to redo Mass Effect 1, so it's more like Mass Effect 2 and 3.
Yeah, it's a lot of textures they have to redo.
It's a lot of textures they'd have to make, because Mass Effect 1, as much as it's probably, it's one of my favorite games of all time, only really has 10 textures.
Blue Shift was the same thing as Human Revolution, though, where Blue Shift was created as a set of bonus levels for the Dreamcast re-release of Half-Life 1, and then that re-release was cancelled. But also that's why they had all the higher res models.
You can put better graphics in a screenshot as well, which helps. Because you can't do that for mechanics.
But, like, I mean, I would totally replay a director's cut of the Mass Effect trilogy where they'd kind of brought the entire thing up to Mass Effect 3 visual style and visuals and maybe ironed over some plot holes and things. But that's probably not what they're going to make. They're going to just put the games in a box again.
Well, it's not a laziness. Like, that is a huge endeavour, what you're describing.
I'm not saying laziness. I said they don't have the resources.
No. It's just,
You know, we keep mentioning Human Revolution's director's cut. I should say that I fucking love that thing.
Yeah,
mostly for the commentary that comes with it. And it, you know, the boss fights doesn't improve them, but it doesn't really fix the kind of core problems with them because that would require
a rewrite.
Huge changes to the entire game if you couldn't kill these characters that were intrinsic to the story in some way. But I like the idea of it as a kind of Criterion Collection style release, like films get. So it's not quite a director's cut, but you get all the people who made it together and getting them to talk about it. And
it's so frankly,
I would totally play a Mass Effect commentary.
That'd
be fucking amazing. I was going to say, like, for Human Revolution, the way they should have done it is done it so that if you insist on trying to do, like, the pacifist run of the game, those bosses are all killed by mysterious accidents immediately after the boss fight. You either see or hear about. Like, you know, you beat some guy and they just, like, after the boss fight, you're both leaving the same building. It's like, well, thanks for showing me the error in my ways. I'll see you later for the finale. And they hit by a truck.
It's just someone someone reprogrammed his robot and strangled him in the shower. Oh, that is why.
Very good. A question was asked by my brother.
Oh, my brother.
Daniel Chaves writes in to ask, hello things Gordon Freeman uses. The main character of Mass Effect 4 will be an Asari whose mother died and was raised by a human father on Earth. She fights for Earth, but suffers discrimination for being a non-human pro-human. My two-part question is, one, since I just made this up, why is it probably not true? Two, what good ideas have you had to take a franchise you love into a radically different direction? Hope you find this idea interesting. Thanks for da-da-da-da-da-da. Daniel Chaves. Harsh. You had an answer to this?
Yeah, I don't know what it was now. Sorry.
I've suggested this before on the podcast, and I think I got laughed, but I still think that Mirror's Edge 2, as well as having kind of free running across rooftops and that sort of thing, when you're inside buildings, you should be able to, like, charge through walls, floors, and ceilings. Like, one of my favourite things about
Mirror's Edge... Like the juggernaut.
Yeah, like the juggernaut. Like, one of my favourite things in Mirror's Edge 1 is the door bash thing.
Yeah.
But a lot of the time when you were inside, because there were kind of more enclosed spaces, you kind of lost the momentum that you had on rooftops that made that such an exhilarating experience. Mm. And so I think, rather than take the kind of, it's a game about climbing up things, you take the, it's a game about freedom of movement and expressive movement through an urban terrain, and so you turn it into the, I've mentioned this so many times now, so many drunken pub conversations, but the building blog article which talks about Die Hard and also the maneuvers of the Israeli military, where instead of moving through streets, they would move through buildings by basically blowing their way through walls so that they couldn't be bombed by, you know, or sniped by enemy soldiers. And so I love that idea. I think that fits into Mirror's Edge world. I think it's a neat escalation of the kind of mechanics of the first game, and it would fit narratively if you were, like, leading a revolution against the city that you were, you know, being oppressed by.
Certainly, I don't think it would fit the tone of the game, which has always been for me about sort of, like, extreme grace and not really leaving a trace on the... And I mean, like, you can play... Like, it seems to me that the skill ceiling in Mirror's Edge is designed around how little of a footprint you leave on the environment. Like, the bad player, you know, kicks and punches the way through the guards and takes the guns and shoots the other guards. The good player sort of nimbly disarms everybody and vanishes up a pipe and, you know...
But then I kind of think that's, like, there's a problem with Mirror's Edge in that they want it to be more of a kind of violent game, but combat doesn't really fit within it, whereas I kind of think that kind of environment destruction is a way of doing something like combat, like a kind of escalation.
So you're saying that, like, Faith has a device or something that allows her to blow out a wall in front of her as she reaches it, like kicking those doors through. So it wouldn't necessarily be you stop to set some C4 up.
Yeah.
Like, bomb another building.
Mm. It's what I always wanted from the Battlefield games, actually. Was not the single-player linear experiences that we got, but more like sandboxes, more like puzzle levels, like... Not quite like Hitman, but where you're given a given area of a city and there are objectives within it, and you do have to... I delivered the same building blog article. I think, when did that come out?
A long time ago now.
But it was prior to one of the more disappointing installments of Battlefield. I remember thinking, oh,
it's been pretty bad. Battlefield 3, I think.
I remember asking them questions about that and them being, we really want to keep you on the, we want to tell a story with this.
Like, no. Oh. The promise of the destruction tech that they keep saying that they've built just never seems to come through, even in multiplayer, where they do a little bit more in terms of buildings collapsing. It's always quite prescriptive.
You can make routes for yourself to some degree in the multiplayer, but not really to the extent that you'd want.
I always found it more convincing in Back Up 2, where they had smaller levels and it felt as though they were much more generous with what you could and couldn't destroy. In fact, entire buildings could collapse on your head with some warning, which they took out of other games. Which felt strange to me, because the most dramatic moments for me were the terrible creaking of, like, the roof structure above you, and you're like, fuck, I've got to get out of here right now. And you could blow a hole, like, you could get your opportunity friend to blow a hole in the wall and breach and clear. You could do that in Back Up 2. It doesn't really feel viable.
Mm. Yeah, I love Back Up 2. It was great.
Yeah, me too.
I can answer both half of this question. The reason his Mass Effect theory is not likely to happen is because it will need to fit within the structures of the original series. And so, not only is it not going to, the game almost certainly not going to be a sequel, because that'll be very difficult for them to manage, given Mass Effect 3's diverse endings, it's also not likely to be a kind of contemporary sidequel either. Like, it's probably going to be, I would suspect, either so far out from the themes and conflicts of the original series that it's just a sort of its own thing, or a kind of prequel in some way. I think the likelihood of it being directly picking up some of the themes from Mass Effect 3 from the side, like the, you know, pro-human, anti-alien kind of sentiment, and dwelling exclusively on them seems incredibly unlikely. The series that I would take in a completely different direction is The Elder Scrolls, and not just because of Tezo. I think that series kind of needs to give up on the notion that it's ever going to really be a good vehicle for telling the linear narrative, at least in the way that it attempts to, with this sort of one plot line that drags you through the world, which has always struggled to involve you in a way that really cares about who your character is. Instead, I think that series needs to learn from kind of a variety of different sources. It needs to learn from MMOs with reactive world events and things like that. It needs to learn from Dark Souls in terms of the way it structures its objectives, the idea of mystery and the sort of labyrinth design where you go off and find things. You're challenged to find two bell towers or whatever, and then the world is yours to go and solve those problems in. And then I think it needs to learn from, like, Animal Crossing and or The Sims or whatever, which it's always gestured at being in terms of embracing being a simulation where the player can seriously affect the economy of a town. And you combine those things together, and I think you'd have a really compelling RPG in an open world where, you know, your job is to find four stones of whatever, and you don't know where they are, and then just let loose into the world, and however you interact with the world, whether that's by farming and selling things to people, or by adventuring, or whatever, helps you gather the clues and information you need to locate and find those things, would be a far more compelling thread to lead you through the world that doesn't need, like, an expensive voice cast bellowing at you. It can just be told through the environment and types of things you're doing to solve a goal. That's, I think, how I make Elder Scrolls 6.
It's interesting, because I spoke to people who... I love that idea, personally. But I know people who find the idea of an open world just inherently daunting, and they dislike the lack of direction and the lack of an objective marker somewhere.
Mm.
And they find that almost like a panicking experience. They're like, fuck, what if, where do I go? And they find the uncertainty unsettling, and they'll go off in a random direction, and they'll constantly be questioning themselves, saying, is this the right thing to do? Is this the right thing to do?
I think...
way to play a game.
I think the way to do that is also... I mean, I love game design when it sort of feels a bit like a magic trick, especially when it's how it's directing the player. I think the way to do it is, at the start of the game, to allow the player to, whether they realise they're doing it or not, pick one of five doors in the path they take into the rest of the game, and have each of them feel initially like the critical path, even though none of them are.
Mm.
So, you know, there'll be the person who goes, I started playing, and I went down, and then I was, you know, Tom Nook told me to farm fish forever so that I could pay off my debt in the village, so I did that. And that person probably wouldn't feel the stress of the open world, even though they don't realise that if they turned right rather than left, they would have been sent off to do something completely different. And let people actually uncover that stuff later when they're ready for it. Like, that, I think, would be a more interesting way of doing it. Rather than just be like, you know, what they always talk about, the, you're in an open world, go! It'd be, you know, like, just allowing people to fall into a situation and learn, which is an interesting experience in and of itself, that they can pull themselves out of it. Not do it. You know what I mean? You can't just leave town.
Pretty sweet.
I think they tried to do the dynamic events thing that you said that you wanted them to learn from MMOs, the Guild Warsian type stuff, because that was the idea originally behind the Dragon Fates, was that, you know, Oblivion had these Oblivion gates that were dotted around the landscape that you would stumble across, but that was kind of a tedious thing. And if you wanted to draw players into the main quest, then dragons were a much more dramatic and a way of doing that, and they would attack you at any time
into
that world. And they kind of do, but it doesn't really work.
I think that part of it does work. I think what I mean by those event systems is, I mean, like, every zone in, like, the later half of Guild Wars 2 is built around repeating like event cycles. That isn't, it's necessary for them to repeat in an MMO. But, you know, if this thing happens, then this happens. And sort of, like, sequences of events that branch on success and failure and change the state of the world.
You're talking about, like, towns getting destroyed if one particular...
Yeah, that's the example that always gets trotted out in interviews about MMOs 3 years before they're released, and those features don't exist. But,
I can't remember how far I went with it, but that was also the idea behind the Civil War in Skyrim, wasn't it? Stormcloaks versus...
Imperials,
They were going to be... There would be a dynamic
mod
front line. You know,
there's a mod that restores that stuff. I think we've spoken about it before.
Yeah. Iron Green writes, I've decided that I don't believe in puns, so I'll just go with a boring yet genuine hello. Hello.
There's quite a lot of people who have just gone for hello this time around.
We've broken the pun cycle.
Yeah. We're free. Post pun film.
Episode 40 has happened.
Who wants a beer? You can keep reading, Graham. I'm just going to get beer to everybody.
Okay. Get beer.
I love beer.
I'm writing today to ask for your opinions on something. Perhaps I'm playing devil's advocate here, but I want to know whether you kind folks believe it is realistically possible for any well-made and fun indie title to have the same success as Tom Francis's Gunpoint or Mike Bethrow's, he means Bethel's, Thomas Was Alone, without the developer having some previous experience in the industry. Phil Fish was a game designer on games before his indie debut. Mike Bethel had game development experience, and Tom obviously was a journalist. Do we think these kinds of backgrounds make it easier to get media attention for your games and therefore allows for a higher level of success? Or do we think that you could come in as a complete unknown and still find your way to Tom Francis' levels of fame and fortune?
I think you need some kind of canniness about how you present these things, but I don't think that's, you know, there is any kind of solid prerequisite for a career.
That you have to spend years in the industry to be a breakout success. Like, Notch just made Minecraft, and then people discovered it.
Mm. You've been doing stuff beforehand, right? I mean, you'd made Worm and things.
He was on Worm, I suppose, yeah.
Well, like, you've got to start somewhere, and even Worm had success, right, to a degree.
No one really knew him from Worm, though.
No, right.
I, you know, make a website in which we write about games quite regularly, and if I get an email from almost daily, if we get an email from someone saying, hey, check out this game, if I've played a game by then before that I enjoyed, then I'll be more excited, but I'm not more likely to write about it. And if I get an email from someone I've never heard of about a game that I know nothing about, I'll still check it out, and if it's cool, I'll still write about it. So I don't know how much difference it really makes, or how much extra coverage or attention you're likely to get.
I think it's fair to say that the first thing people do in this industry is almost all of the time not going to be the thing that makes them rich.
Well, that's true of everything. Every field.
It's true of everything everywhere. But, you know, the point about Tom or Mike or any of those, or Notch or any of those guys, is that, you know, they made a successful, profitable game, having spent years in the industry gaining experience doing something relevant to that success. It's not that they, you know, got a shortcut to success, because Tom wrote for PC Gamer for like 9 years. Like, it's not, you know, it's simply that you don't find the golden egg. Let's go with that. I said that.
Where's the egg?
I keep saying that. It's fine. Where's the egg? The egg is probably with that old lady from the first panel, and you don't know it now, but you'll know it later. The point is people have to gain experience one way or another, and your first game, just by sending it to the press or whatever, is not necessarily going to be the thing that makes you rich. It's probably going to be game 10.
Yeah, but there's no rule against it. Like, I don't think there's any... I mean, you just have to work hard, don't you? I mean, Tom put the hours into making Gunpoint. It was his first game. It was probably his first... In fact, it was the first game he experimented with making as well.
Pretty much, within Game Maker, it was the first thing he...
Obviously, people wrote about it, and the spin on that story was, oh, look, it's by that guy that we know, and he is also a journalist. But I don't know if that helped him inordinately. I mean, he could have achieved that by himself anyway.
He got a lot of coverage from journalists he didn't know. And it was kind of a story that, oh yeah, this former journalist makes game, but he got covered by Kotaku and stuff like that. Mm. And he didn't know anyone who was writing about the game there.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a game that people want to cover, then people will more often than not cover it.
I think the thing is, like, your first game, or if you've never made a game before, your first game's probably not going to be very good. But if it is good, then people write about it, as was Tom's case, I think.
The thing is, you can lower the barrier for people to work out whether they care about your game. It's not like they need to recognize your name before they'll click a link. And you can convey whether your game is interesting in a GIF. And I can watch a GIF by clicking it, or, you know, a YouTube video. It's so easy to convince me that a thing is cool and worth exploring more of. And it's way more likely to come on the strengths of the game and the media or the screenshots or whatever that you created for it than it is the fact that I've heard of you before.
Mm.
Lots of people I've heard of make very boring games.
And there's loads and loads of people we don't know who constantly churn out games. Like, the jams are just full of people whose names I've never heard who are making incredible stuff.
Mm. And those jams are full of people.
Full of people.
Basically, people should email us more often.
Yeah.
All
yeah,
four of us are in a position
it's
to
weird.
Spread
I had this weird experience when I just started as acting ed on Game Over for the 3 months I was. I tweeted just to say, like, hey, I've got a preview section to fill for the next 3 months. Mm. If you've made something cool that I can probably play right now, let me know.
Yeah.
And it got retweeted, like, not just around, it got retweeted a lot. And then, like, mistweeted in the context of, like, finally someone is making the cold, unfeeling, AAA-obsessed press open to everyone. I was like, no, that really wasn't my mission. So, like, I'd like people to email me their cool games more. And, you know, a lot of the stuff we got sent, I couldn't cover because, like, it wasn't ready or it wasn't interesting yet or whatever. And try and be honest and offer feedback where you can. But it was the notion, if you're an indie developer, there's no way in hell that emailing someone a link to a playable build of your cool game is a bad thing.
Yeah.
Like, ever.
Just say what it is quickly. Mm. Maybe have a video. Best thing ever is just having a playable build. Like, if we can play it and write about it, that's so valuable.
If we can play it, yeah. It's so much easier to cover it.
Yeah.
Really, so much easier. Because you're not then just relaying a promise. Like, you are then actually relaying an experience, and that's a much more powerful thing.
Yeah.
Patrick Rickett writes, hello, as per Tom F's recommendation, I've been playing Make It Good. Make It Good is the text adventure about an alcoholic detective that we talked about on the last episode. Mm. And I've been finding something I don't normally find with games or everyday activities. I've been making use of my professional skill set. Perhaps because he's an alcoholic. This is because whilst I spend most of my time being a university undergraduate / dozing / replaying Mass Effect, maybe it's you, Chris. I'm also a special constable.
No, I'm the other thing.
Essentially a part-time volunteer police officer in my local force. As part of training, we're taught how to respond to incidents and the basics of how to investigate martial evidence. And I found myself consciously working through decision models and evidential building blocks. This is the coolest guy.
Yeah.
Are there any games where you found yourself consciously using any professional / workplace skills? Cheers, Patrick Rickett. It's an awkward question to ask.
Game journalist. Yeah, exactly. That was going to be my response, yeah.
Either all games or no games, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, I guess as someone who writes things, never. Which is why my parents said I would never get a job.
Need to be more grammar-based games, maybe.
Maybe so.
I was going to say, like, I fully agree. Professionally, now? No. No transferable useful skills whatsoever. Yeah. But, I did find that, I found this generally in life, but a lot of improv training stuff, just like mental help focusing techniques and things that you learn when you are learning to improvise, are very, very useful in competitive games as well.
Hmm.
I've written about improv and Dota in a different context, really more about, like, interacting with other people and how you create a solution to a problem by improvising in Dota. But personally, like, just things about focus and being able to find focus and energy to perform at the highest level you're capable of performing is a useful thing I learned from that part of my life that I still apply before doing anything competitive now. Like, I don't like to walk in to Game of Dota kind of groggy and distracted, much as I was always terrified of walking onto a stage groggy and distracted. Mm. So having ways of clearing your mind and focusing and sharpening has been very, very useful to me generally.
I want to hear more about
being a special constable.
Yeah, a special constable record and how his skills are applicable to Make It Good or any other detective game.
Yeah.
Please write in again. JR writes, dear Cape and Cloak Bar, Chris has said previously that there aren't any traditionally protagonist-y characters in Dota 2.
That's the word I used.
Which is true, except as someone who suffers generalized anxiety, I think it clearly has to be Timbersaw, and I can't stop thinking of him as the main character. Can you think of a character from a game's fiction that wasn't designated or intended as the protagonist, but still resonated with you strongly enough that you began to see their story as the most important? Continually hoping this week's question is more coherent to JR. You'll have to explain who Timbersaw is.
Timbersaw is a little goblin guy in a sort of timber, like a lumberjacking mech. But it's a nice inversion of what normally happens. Like, a lot of Valve's writing for the game inverts what you would expect from the same fantasy trope. So rather than him being from the evil race of forest-clearing goblins, and having a... There is a tree ant character in the game, you know, and having a tree ant character be the people that attack him. His village was wiped out by trees. And so he... like, sentient evil trees. So he built a suit of lumberjacking armor and is now terrified of trees and is having, like, a nervous... Because the Dota map is covered in trees and his abilities all use the trees in some way. Like, he can fire a chain to a tree and drag himself towards it like a grappling hook.
But he's constantly in a terrified of trees.
And also, like, you know, there are rival lines in Dota. If he's in a, if you put him in a lane with Treant Protector, who's the Treant character, he kind of freaks the fuck out a little bit. Like, there's a tree standing next to me, isn't there? And hello. It's good. Anyway, that's Timbersaw. The, non-Dota part of this question is characters who are not the intended protagonist of a game.
I think that happens quite often, that you sympathise more with characters externally to you, because your character is so often blank slate that you, it's hard to impart real empathy. But, RPGs are particularly vulnerable to that, where obviously you're designed to find the characters around you and your party interesting and worth saving, whereas you are often, you know, insert name here, bald man.
I mean, like, Half-Life 2 is a game about Alex, and certainly the episodes, if you look at who has an actual character arc, an emotional arc, and development, well, it's Alex. Gordon Freeman, who just gets magically warped into these situations and says nothing. Ross Meredith writes, "Dear Mates and Crowbros, life is essentially a game in which we play roles, right? What options appear in your personal conversation wheel? Keep on potting, Russ."
I think, well, based on the things I say daily to people, some sort of, just sort of, like, meaningless honk that communicates anything from a greeting to farewell to do you want a cup of tea is basically the only item left on the conversation wheel that Marsh and I share for cohabitation.
Put that away! Don't show me that. Can I touch it?
Who's saying this to who?
You're both just saying it to each other.
No one else to be online. So there's some sort of like...
Give me 20 minutes before you use the toilet.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. Probably in work... There's the phrase, "thing is," which is followed by ellipsis and then a rant. But that requires a more freeform system. I don't know. What would be on yours, Graham?
I don't have an answer to the question.
That's a shame. I think I would have, "hello."
Hello?
Hurrah for Boulder. That's sadness. But hurrah for Skeleton. That'll be it.
I can actually imagine. I think, Tom, you're probably the person I can imagine most communicating solely through Dark Souls emotes.
Oh, that's a challenge.
Just
there.
Walking through a door with your arms in the air. Like, there's a great gif I'll try to dig out. I don't know if I'm about to find it again for the show notes, but there's a sort of... like a celebratory greeting, praise the sun thing. Where
What is it?
Yeah, you walk forward a few steps and raise your hands in the air in a sort of V, in a Y shape. And there's a great gif of somebody walking through a door in Dark Souls doing the, "what is it?" And as they open the door, there's a player on the other side who just immediately closes the door in their face. Like, praise
the sun. What is it? Denied.
Yeah.
Nick writes, Dear Pirates and Pyrobars, much of the recent discussion on sales and discounted games missed out an important part of my decision to purchase a game, the presence of a demo. I'd love to pay a developer full price for a game, but if I'm unable to test a game before purchase, then waiting until it is discounted becomes a more attractive option.
That seems sensible.
I would love to hear what the team thinks about demos and how they, the demos, not the teams, interact with discounts. Sorry if I'm opening a safely closed debate. Fans for listening, everybody.
I like demos, but they're not always possible for every game. Like, I think he... Does he pick an example there?
Democracy 3 is...
Yeah, it's a really difficult game to demo. You've got to time lock it, basically, because otherwise you don't see its system, which is the entirety of the game.
But I also see the importance of that demo. And I actually agree with his point. I think his point is a really useful counterpoint to Klifsky's argument against discounts, in that you are...
What was Klifsky's argument? I don't
know. The discounts are terrible. And
he did argue that. Did he say anything about why he didn't have a demo for Democracy 3?
I don't recall, so to be fair.
It's Klifsky, creator of Democracy 3 that we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm pretty sure he did have one for Democracy 2, and it was a case of you could play it up to the first election or something.
Okay.
But I, to be honest, in that kind of game, even if you time limit it in that way, you sort of can just... don't need to buy the game. Like, the thing that's fun about it, you can kind of satiate by playing that chunk.
Yeah, but that's not information that the person playing the chunk of demo will know necessarily from a sales point of view. Like, I think it's a fair point to, like, say that if you are asking players not to wait for discounts, then you have to give them everything they need to know that they want to buy the game now and lower the risk of that initial investment. Because it's all about risk, right? Like, it's about, if I buy this at full price, I risk not liking it and having wasted loads of money. And, yeah, I mean, I think it's a huge shame that demos have become less prevalent, generally. I mean, we're still focusing on indie games here, but it's completely true for almost everything that you don't have a chance to, you know, play something before you buy it. And there's no reason why not. As far as I can tell.
There's been, like, a bunch of talks at, like, GDC and stuff like that, where people have basically come forward with statistical data to say that demos reduce the number of sales. They don't increase it. But the reason for that is that people try your game, realize they don't like it, and then they don't buy it. And so there is an ethical argument that says that you should offer a demo rather than taking people's money on dishonest terms.
Yeah, you don't want to cheat people into buying a game. Well, maybe you do, I don't know.
Like, it just, this is what I mean. Like, I think, especially, well, particularly, if you're not going to offer a demo, but you are planning to offer a discount in 3 months, then you can't really complain when people wait for that discount, I don't think, because you haven't offered them no compelling reason to buy the game at release. Because you have given them no opportunity to try it for themselves and find out if they like it, even in a minimal form. I think that's fair. Like, especially when the kind of... It's not like films, where going to see a film is expensive, but a film is easily demoed in the form of a trailer, which gives you some sense. I mean, obviously, trailers can be misleading. Mm. They can be misleading, but it is far more of a one-to-one representation of the kind of experience you will have if you go and look at these pictures and hear these sounds for a bit. Whereas, you know, games require that. Like, a game trailer is not really a trailer in the same way that a film trailer is, because a film trailer is the same medium as the thing it is advertising, whereas a game trailer is a video of something else.
I think it's that, like, people don't make purchasing decisions based on actual practical or quantitative information. They go, like, we talked earlier about Star Wars and how just earlier today, the new cast for the next Star Wars movie was announced, and the original actors are going to be in there. And StarWars.com crashed at that point because so many people piled on. Now, if people were making kind of... A lot of people are going to go see the new Star Wars film when it comes out, but if they were making that decision practically, they would remember that the last three Star Wars films weren't very good. But they're going to make that decision emotionally. And that's kind of... That's true of everything, which is why car adverts are about driving down a cool-looking road, you know, rather than being about the actual merits of the car. And similarly, I think people try and sell video games on the same grounds. And so developers, companies, marketers, they want to sell it to you not based on the actual experience you're going to have. which is what you'll discover if you play the demo. They want to sell it to you based on the trailer, which is what conveys some emotional fantasy.
And yeah, it's what I'm saying, right?
Dishonesty.
What I'm saying, Graham, is fuck those people.
Yeah. I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you.
I enjoyed it. My favorite advert is actually perfume adverts, which is a concept that's so hard to communicate through a trailer.
They've given off on a patch.
Just got mental nonsense. Maybe games should go in that direction.
I'd love that if, like, the advert for the next Call of Duty was like a man in khaki with a tiger running towards him in slow motion through a pool of mercury that is like evaporating around the tiger.
And it's got rows in his teeth.
Yeah, it's like Call of Duty for men.
I love the kind of adverts in the run up to Christmas where it's just like baffled fathers on TV going like, I don't know what's happening! Go to Boots, buy them all perfume, it's be fine. You know, it's just purely predicated on the notion.
That's me.
So this problem, yeah.
I'm an idiot and don't know my family at all. I'll go to W.H. Smith. Jimmy Jazz writes, hey, Crate and Crowbarians. This question goes to Chris specifically.
All good.
Since you've driven yourself mad modding Skyrim, as you've mentioned several times on the cast, maybe I don't have to? Could you put your list of modications up so I could give it a try?
What modification are you taking?
What modifications have you given Skyrim? This isn't his bad spelling, this is my bad reading out loud. He wants to know what modifications you're using on Skyrim.
I will find some time this week to put a full list on the forum. I went back to it this weekend, again, after keep saying that I won't, and I did. And it's still nice. It's a nice game, full of sky.
And any rims?
I don't go to that part of Skyrim Nexus.
Actually, one other thing, I know, Chris, you have...
Only if you're desperate for some skooma.
Everyone's desperate for skooma.
Actually, it's not illegal in Skyrim.
Is it not? I've killed a man for trying to sell me skooma. Maybe I'm the criminal in this scenario. I know that you've got... talk about people who are new to the Mass Effect series.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a potential guide for people... So what order to install
this, oh god,
in order to maintain narrative.
So I can't find, and this is probably the most awful and damning sentence I'll ever say about myself, I can't find the Moleskine notebook where I wrote down my list of the correct order of Mass Effect 2 mods in.
What a nightmare.
But if I can find it, I maybe I should list that. So the purpose of that list, because it's not mods, Mass Effect 2 does have mods, but the most like texture upgrades and things, like 4K packs and stuff like that. However, there's a lot of DLC for that game, not just story DLC, but weapon packs, armor packs, costume packs. I came up with a correct order to install those things in based on key plot points that makes them make logical sense within the framework of the narrative. So that, for example, because I hate that thing when you install a BioWare game for the first time and you've got all the DLC activated, and the first time Shepard gets into the Normandy or you get into Kirkwall in Dragon Age 2 or whatever, it just bombards you with free shit that comes from nowhere in the plot. Right? The provenance of those items makes no sense relative to where the Normandy is or what's happening around it. So I came up, and that bothers me, because I'm insane. And it bothers me specifically because it breaks my immersion. And so I came up with a list that explains, like, the firepower pack includes a lot of weapons that look kind of Asari in provenance, so it makes sense to install that after the first time you go to Ilium, obviously. And if you want that list as well, then, you know, fuck it. Yeah, cool. If it's useful to another human being ever, then...
You want to go maximum narrative on Aspect, then that's a good list.
Like, fucking maximum lore. Yeah. Full bore lore full all lore, the time.
That's awesome.
I am the lore.
Actually, it really annoyed me in Dark Souls 2, where... like, I bought it, like, a few hours before release so I could pre-order it. So preload it. And it gives you, like, a load of swords and shields.
Yeah, I wasn't strong-willed enough not to use them, I'm afraid.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I did think about it, then I thought, yeah, I like hitting things and killing
them. You're part of the problem, man.
Yeah, no.
I started as a deprived character, which is the naked dude, with no weapons, apart from the DLC weapons. Mm. And I was like, I didn't think it would drop them straight to your inventory for some reason, even though that's what always happens. And I was so angry because
did you discard them?
No, I didn't. I kept them in there. I never used them. I fought up with my fists, and until I punched enough ghouls that I could wield a basic dagger. It was miserable, Martin. Especially
Tom gets it. That is annoying when that happens. Yeah, like, it punches the, like...
Yeah, it's just like, knowing they're there, it's just like, no.
It's just why all DOC is bullshit, though.
Mm. Well, it's not, like, it is possible to follow this. It's just that game developers, when they're incorporating this stuff, especially into any game that has a progression for the player's power level that's quite important to the story and the feel of the game, which is true of Dark Souls as well as it is of Mass Effect, they need to have the balls to say, we are selling you a weapon pack, but your character's not going to get them all at once. You know, we're adding new weapons to appropriate parts of the game. So you're expanding laterally in terms of diversity of stuff available, but you're not adding stuff that's overpowered early in the game or anything else. It's like, hey, you know this, like middle part of the game where there are currently 8 weapons available? Really? There's now going to be 10. Like, that's fine. But they need to be paced and folded into the structure of the game in a way that makes sense. It can't just be your level 1 character gets them all dumped into their inventory. Like, there's this ludicrous bit at the beginning of Dragon Age 2. Hawk, the main character, and his family, or her family, escapes a terrible thing, terrible disaster, and gets on a boat and goes to a different city halfway across the world. And then you do your initial quests and stuff, and then you get house. And in the chest, in that house, if you've installed the collector's edition and everything else, it's just a vast pile of priceless, powerful, magical bullshit. And it breaks this notion that you're this refugee family having just arrived in a city that hates you. Like, it puts a spear through the narrative immediately. And I have no problem. None of that stuff is badly written or looks bad or anything. The problems aren't with the items themselves. It's fully on how they're introduced to the game. And it's graceless and shit. And that's why I made that list for Mass Effect 2, because it incorporates those items into the game in a way that folds them into the main narrative. It is, like we were talking about earlier, the director's cut of the game, where that stuff's all in the box from level 1, and you just get it at a point where it makes sense, as opposed to it feeling like, oh, well, you know, beginning of Mass Effect 3, you have 15 million emails saying, like, hey, Shepard, we happened to find this cool-looking hat. We've put it in your wardrobe for later, in case you want it. Thanks for pre-ordering.
Deus Ex Human Revolution had a really bad pre-order.
Yeah, it did.
It was the magic unlock, door of things was one of them.
Yeah, and it gave you fuckloads of currency, which meant that you weren't making any interesting decisions for the first 3 hours, because you just bought all the upgrades you wanted. Yeah. So you weren't making any, like, oh, I want to have super strength or super...
Even if that made narrative sense, it just unbalances the game. Yeah. It's like, either your game was unbalanced to begin with, and this fixes it, or it breaks it.
Yeah, totally.
It breaks it.
Boo. Boo. Boo on that.
Boo to things. Boo on that.
And hurrah for Baldur's.
Sadness. Because that's all the time for questions we have.
If you want to send us more questions, email them to us at questions@creatingcrowbar.com or tweet us at creatingcrowbar. That's on the Twitters. You can tweet us individually.
Twitters.
We are individual twits.
Yeah, true. I'm Marsh Davis on the Twitter. DAVIES.
I am at Gunnis, GONNAS.
I am at C Thurston, CTHURSTEN.
I am at PCDLudo, LUDO.
Well, what is it?
Which we forgot to mention the forums.
Does that doesn't really matter.
Okay. There's a forum. Tom just burped.
It was more than one. I always tried to hold it in, but it made a lot of noise within me. And
normally our outros are kind of rushed and weird. This one has kind of gained a life of its own. Yeah, I don't know what's happening.
We just need to do the finishing.
I know, but no one wants to now. It's because
I don't.
The mystery of it's gone.
Yeah, everyone knows what's about to happen.
Yeah, it's basically
like, all the people listening to this appreciate what
it's basically fucking Pipe Mania now. That's
it. Yeah, it's worn off.
You can't, you know, take us to the head. You know.
Always looking for that room.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Also, the forums at creatingcrowbar.com/forum.